welcome to everyone. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm Henrik, and you're listening to Red Eyes Radio. The website is redeyescreations.com. As you guys and gals probably know, if you're a regular listener, is that we like to examine history, real history, untainted by the morals and views of our current times of modernity. We seek a real insight into the past, not bound to our current standards of what should or shouldn't be. I think to do otherwise is to not recognize the needs and reasoning of those people who came before us, to have this view that, they were the idiots and brutes, and we today are the smart, intelligent, and sensitive ones, is not to be honest, as they were in most cases facing completely different circumstances than what we do today. We want to know why certain things happened, and not just blame those who historically have reacted and responded to something, but we want to know what initiated that response, be that war and conflict or peace and alliances. To have a perception that hatred, aggression, and violence just springs out of nowhere, out of the blue, like lightning on a clear day, is equal to believing that things are not connected, that our history is somehow disjointed, and that you can just pick a year, any year in the history books, and claim to understand the reasoning of those times and of the people living at those times without looking at the events that came before that particular year. We don't like to view history from a contrarian perspective just because we like to go against the grain. I think it's important to realize that we end up going against the grain because everything is the wrong side up. It's in the wrong direction, 180 degrees. History is what has been laid in the wrong direction. In other words, the history we know is a lie. And most of it, not all, but most of it has been constructed in that way. Today, history is used against us, so it's important that we constantly reevaluate what we're told to discover that it's a method by which the establishment is seeking to use it against us, both politically and psychologically. It's a shame that it's come to this, but history as we know it, most of it has been turned into a weapon. So instead of reading history through the interpretations of academics and Marxist professors, why not go to the people themselves who lived at the time and hear what they have to say about their experiences and challenges in life, if that material is available, that is. So that's what we're going to do today concerning the westward movement of European settlers and pioneers as they came into greater and greater conflict with the American Indians. Our guest is Tom Goodridge. He's the author of Scalp Dance, Indian Warfare on the High Plains. A very interesting book that I think will give you a very different view, a neglected perspective of the challenges that the people who came to America faced at that time and why consequently certain things unfolded in the way they did. It's that untold history, the suppressed testimony that is so important to get to if we are to understand not only both sides, but in particular the side that has been the most demonized historically. Welcome back, Mr. Goodridge. It is great speaking to you once again. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing excellent, Henry. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been really busy, of course, the last week here so far, week and a half in terms of the Paris shooting and the situation in Europe. A lot of things to go through, a lot of things to look into. So it's we're keeping busy as usual, you know.
Well, let's talk about that later on. How about that? Of course, we're interested over on this side of the ocean also about what's going on in not only Paris and France, but all of Europe. So I'm more than willing to shoot from the hip, as they say.
All right, great. Yeah, let's definitely keep that in mind later here as we continue. But we're going to begin on talking more about your book, Scalp Dance, Indian Warfare on the High Plains from 1865 to 1879. It's the reviews on the book are just fantastic. I was just going through them once again today on Amazon. I mean, people are so glad that you wrote this book in order for those who actually are interested in real history in the subject to get a chance to hear from someone that actually is beyond the, well, I would call it revisionist view, politically correct history that basically just serves to guilt and shame specifically white Americans today. Tell us why you wanted to write this book and how it came about, Tom.
Well, I am from the western states of America, so I lived, you might say, I lived the history. It was no problem to go see certain sites, places where General Custer had Indian fights places where people were captured and fought and died all too often. So I grew up in that element. I also went to school with Indians, by the way. I went to school with quite a few of them, actually. And I understood, I thought, the Indians that I, in fact, one of my best friends was an Indian and one of the most talented people I'd ever met, too. He could do anything, virtually anything. But Henrik, I've got a nose, apparently, or a gene, let's put it that way. I have a gene, a genetic predisposition to seek out those subject matters which have either been covered up or not covered well. And in this case, I think a little bit of both, covered up and not covered well. That's the so-called American Indian Wars. And I focused, this book is focused, as you mentioned with the subtitle, on that period most quintessential, quintessentially American. I think when you Europeans think of America, a lot of you still think of cowboys and Indians.
Yeah.
And I think that's still very much our character here in America, because it was such a colorful, pivotal event in American history. The Indian Wars, my God. America moving west, this electric steam and iron behemoth starting to move from the East Coast after the American Civil War toward the West Coast, the Pacific Coast. And in the way, of course, are thousands, tens of thousands of Native Americans, indigenous Americans, Native American Indians, the Sioux, the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Comanche, the Apache, the Kiowa, the Sioux, all the Indians that foreigners think of when they think of America, with the war bonnets, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. And then there's General Custer, of course, the white soldier and his 7th Cavalry that are fighting them. And so it's a natural for me to go to that subject matter because I love it, quite honestly. But also, back to the genetic predisposition for controversy, I had realized that I was growing up in a very convoluted historical environment. As I was growing up, it was the same thing that we're hearing today, only it was less. Let's say it was Indians all good, white man all bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I grew up in. As I went on to college, it was even more exaggerated. And I knew that there was nothing to that. I simply knew that I'd done enough research. But I wanted to write a book, a corrective, if you will, to all the nonsense that was being put out at that time, not only in books and history and in fiction, but also in the movies. I grew up loving the movie Little Big Man. That's a wonderfully entertaining movie starring Dustin Hoffman about a man who, an old survivor, 120 some years old, and he's being recorded about his memories of the Indian Wars, and it's a wonderful movie. It's all fiction, of course. I mean, there's very little in it that's true. But movies like that, and more recently, the Dances with Wolves, they paint a different picture of the Indian Wars, then it really happened.
Mm.
They're lovely, they're beautiful to watch, and entertaining as hell, but they're not true. In fact, there's the opening scene in Little Big Man of the little boy and his sister. They're crawling out from underneath a wagon that's just been attacked and burned by Indians. And the subject, the conversation between the kids is that, oh boy, we're in for it now when they find us. That's all she wrote. And the little girl, who's probably 15, 16, something like that, she's being very melodramatic and saying, oh boy, when they get a hold of me, you know what will happen then. But it's the way she's saying that she's obviously secretly desires to be ravished by a whole tribe of Indians. You can tell she's a sex starved, not very attractive, and she thinks there would probably be nothing better than to be raped and sodomized by a bunch of red men. And of course, that's the message that's being delivered. Well, let me tell you this. Of course, she wasn't. When the Indians found her, rather than kill Jack as they would have done her brother, who was about 12 or 13, and rather than, well, she would have got her wish with spades and aces had that been real Indians, because she would have been raped up and down. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But no, she wasn't even harmed. In fact, it seemed the last thing those Indians would have wanted to do was force themselves sexually upon this woman voluntarily, or involuntarily, rather. And, of course, they wouldn't even do it voluntarily because she wasn't very good looking. But let me say this, that I'm I mean that seriously, that she would have been turned every which way but loose had they had it been a real situation. So it's things like that and other propagandistic movies. You know, okay, I'll cut right to the chase with this. When you turn your culture over to your worst enemies, this is what happens. They make movies that are that are against the host culture. Jews run Hollywood. I don't have to say this. Hopefully everybody who's listening to this program already knows that.
Yeah.
They own the American media. And the American media is spread around the globe, let's face it. I'm sure you, even in Sweden, heard of the movie Little Big Man and Dances with Wolves and movies like that. So when you have a people that are diametrically opposed to your culture, hate your culture, then you have things like, yes, Dances with Wolves, movies that portray the Indians in idyllic fashion. Let me say this. In America, maybe you've even heard this in Europe, but in America, we grow up, school children, we grew up with this mantra about the American Indian. And it goes without saying, nobody ever disputed it. The American Indian, when he killed a buffalo, he used every part of that animal possible. In other words, he didn't waste anything. He used the horns for utensils to eat with. He used the hide, the wool for cover, for coats and for blankets and for teepees. Of course, he ate the meat. He used virtually everything. I don't know what he used the guts for and things like that, but apparently he used them somehow. That's the mantra. And, truly there is some, well, there is some truth to that, and there's also some falseness to that. Fact is, well, like many other lies our elders told us, lies like World War II is the good war, and the World War II veterans are the greatest generation, gallant little Israel, and Jews as a history scapegoats. There's some half-truths. True, the American Indian used every piece of the buffalo possible when he had very little buffalo, when in the times of winter, when there was famine, when there was nothing to eat. Yes, he used everything, virtually everything, even chewed the tail, so I understand. But in times, this is things that are left out of that mantra. In times of plenty, I found that the American Indian could be just as wasteful as any white man ever born.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, a white man on the prairie, a farmer, a soldier, whatever, he could be very wasteful with a buffalo. Yes, it's a recorded fact that white people shot buffalo from the trains, just shot them for the hell of it, shooting them like crazy. But in the winter, when they had very little food, yes, the white man could be as economical of the buffalo as any Indian alive. On the other hand, an Indian could be just as wasteful as any white man when there were plenty of buffalo. I've got plenty of accounts, not necessarily in this book, but in my research, of Indians hunting just for sport, hunting to kill the animal itself when there were plenty of them. Often, and to this very day, in the American West, are cliffs. We call them drops. It's places where Indians would herd buffalo over the sides of cliffs. Not necessarily the cliff that you have in mind. This could be 50, 25 feet, anything that would break an animal's leg so he couldn't get away.
Mm-hmm.
These are the drops I'm talking about. And when the Indians had done this, driven, say, 50 or 100 buffalo over the drop, then they could, at their leisure, they could go among these buffalo and pick what they wanted. The tongue was a succulent delicacy. Indians loved to cut out the tongue of the still living animal, by the way, or cut out a bit of the hump. A hump was also a gourmet item. And leave the rest to rot. Take the rest back to camp, the tongue and a hump, piece of the hump, and let the rest rot. That's the mantra, the thing about the buffalo, the Indian using every aspect of the buffalo, but they don't mention the other things. But the point, the nail they're trying to drive into the wood is that, Indians were very economical, were very patient, and, very, concerned about nature, whereas the white man, no, they just bulldozed everything. They just came in and slaughtered everything. That's the message they're trying to deliver. The Indians, well, let's put it this way. Other animals, never mentioned. You know, the Indian decorated himself. He was a vain person just like white people, just like brown people, black people, very vain. He loved to dress himself up. But guess what? Those beautiful war bonnets that they wore, those were really eagle feathers. They came from real living animals. The elk's teeth they used to adorn themselves with necklaces and bracelets, these also came from real living animals that had to be captured and killed. This to adorn Indians. That's hardly ecologically aware, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure, yeah.
It's things like that that are left out. Bear claws, that's another example. And, of course, hides and furs. And when the Indian finally got the repeating rifle, oh, boy, let me tell you, he was pretty merciless with that weapon. He very, very much like the white man in so many ways.
And so it's very historically unbalanced, and everything is conveniently left out or brought into the picture in order to create this narrative, be that from the environmental angle, be that from, you know, something that Hollywood as a psyop operation have started using to condition people in terms of, you know, who's the protagonist and who's the antagonist, right?
Yes, and but it's so impossible, this paragon of perfection that Jewish Hollywood, the publishers, academia, American Marxist academia, are trying to foist upon white Americans. It's almost an impossible culture. And like I said, the Indians I grew up with, they wouldn't have a clue about what they're talking about right now. Let me say this, that I'm not trying to say that the white man is all good either. In fact, I regret very much how ruthlessly my ancestors savaged the land. Mm. It's one of my greatest regrets that they would. Basically, we have very little pure prairie in America anymore. And that's one of the ecosystems I think I love the most, because it's so subtle and so simple. Pure prairie, prairie grass. It was all farmed over, plowed over, planted crops, wheat, corn, and now there's very, very little of this very delicate ecosystem left. But, you know, those people back then, I cannot project my own sensibilities onto them, because they were hand-to-mouth. These were the ones that couldn't make it in Europe. They had to come over here and find land. In a land-starved continent of Europe, they could come over here and find a lot of it. And so we're not talking about the most sensitive or environmentally aware Americans to begin with.
No,
you've got
some
people that are hand-to-mouth and very ruthless with nature, unfortunately. Damming up the rivers, that's another thing I wish they hadn't have done. And mowing down the forests, but they did. And incidentally,
well, this is survival, Tom. That's what people have to keep in mind. And it's not like, you know, they have this idea that, you know, somehow they did it intentionally, or like to ravage the environment, or to like they were just kind of some psychopathic, ruthless drive that did this. I think it's just the momentum of surviving and the conditions that they were thrown into, because many did flee, you know, religious persecution in Europe and things like that, came to a brand new continent. And it's almost like the engine of that survival was just, you know, going, and perhaps, you know, to such an extent then that, yes, in the end it was detrimentary for them. But at the same time, I don't think there's anything that was done intentionally on this level. There wasn't even there in the consciousness at that point, I think, anyway.
No, you're right, and everything you're saying is correct. And it was a different time, quite honestly. Now, of course, we're trying to do so much better now. We still have the same reckless people doing some terrible things, but mostly they're doing it against our will. The point is, with these anti-white films about Indian all good, white man all bad, is that what it really boils down to, and this has been going on for at least 50 years, last 50 years, 70 years more likely, is trying to hammer home white guilt.
Yeah.
In other words, who on earth could, but we white devils, could so wantonly crush such a peaceful, pastoral, philosophical culture as the American red man? That's the message they're trying to drive home, and it's succeeded. It has succeeded.
Oh, certainly.
I remember very clearly back in the early 1960s, one of the commercials that came out that really started the momentum was a commercial on TV, and Americans were notoriously how do I want to say this delicately? Oh, hell with it. Let's just say it. We were very filthy people. We would throw trash out the windows, beer bottles, pop bottles, throw them at signs. American highways were littered with filth, quite honestly. Mm. And I can remember myself throwing stuff out. Nobody thought a thing about it. But in this commercial, it shows white Americans driving down in their enormous cars, throwing all manner of trash out the windows. And then as they go by, there's this Indian by the roadside, who was an Italian, by the way, not even a red Indian. But there's a tear coming down out of his cheek. In other words, the message is clear. Only, you know, you're despoiling my land, you pigs. You filthy, vile infidels. You're destroying my land. Look what's happened to it. And by the way, as an aside, let me say this, Henrik. Any person who's been to an American Indian reservation, brother, they're just about as filthy as the white man was throwing his trash out. So there's nothing good there. But back to the point is that with our culture, in control of our worst enemies, they're trying to drive home white guilt. And they've done a very damn good job of it, too. Let's face it. Control of the American media is not so much about control as I think it's trying to make us quite extinct, or at least shut us down to the point that we're easily manageable. We've come to the point now, in fact, I don't think it's gotten that much better. Certainly there's a renaissance occurring in the white world, especially U.S. and Europe. But still, the object, I think, is to convince us of our own innate evil and depravity, mm-hmm. for nearly making the red Indians extinct, so that, number one, we hate ourselves. If we hate ourselves, we're more likely to mate with other races because we want to put as much distance between our skin and another skin as possible. We don't want to be white anymore because, let's face it, whites are devils. We crushed this beautiful, magnificent, peaceful, pastoral culture. And so who would want to do that? Hell, I don't want to think of it. My culture has just wantonly crushed this beautiful, godlike culture. And I also think that, number two, if we truly do start hating ourselves, we're less likely to have children because we don't want to pass on such evil genes. Let's face it. I mean, who wants to propagate even more devils to come on and do more bad things in the world? And number three, of course, it's most apparent, I think, especially if you hate yourself, you're more prone to suicide, drugs, booze, sickness. Mm. It's in other words, I think it's deliberate, and I think it's working to quite a degree. Of course, there are many of us that will never buy into it, and will be dealt with later on, or at least that's what they hope. But see how quickly I get political here?
It's really easy. It's hard not to, because as we know, history has been politicized, and we can no longer view it. Well, we tried to, but we can no longer view it from that objective lens. It's always like how it's being skewed and whatnot. And again, I go back to that point. That's what it's so important what you've done in the book, just as you did in Hellstorm as well, and we'll see if we can talk a little bit more about that later too. But, you know, drawing heavily from diaries, from letters and memoirs, you know, from the American plain settlers in order to, you know, so that the reader can really get into the mind of those who actually took part in these wars and these conflicts. So let's just talk about that a little bit. What happened and what kind of world that they described, and what was the reason for all these wars to take place in the way they did, Tom?
Yes, the book is a history, and the book is in the words of the people themselves. I've made a cottage reputation, you might say, out of first person, you are there, history books. It's not about me, it's about them. It's letting them do the talking, just like in Hellstorm and virtually every other book I've written. What it was like to go west, what it was like to fight Indians, what it was like to be captured by Indians if you're a woman. The subtitle is, Scalp Dance, the Indian Wars in the High Plains, 1865, which was the end of the American Civil War, to 1879, which more or less is the end of the Indian Wars. And so, in that period, that quintessential American period where Americans are moving west across these beautiful, vast, treeless prairies. That's the subject matter of this book. And it is a book about battles and wars, the wars that were being waged, because I find it fascinating. All wars, how people deal with wars, how people deal with death. I find that fascinating. I'm not in love with it, quite honestly. I hope to make it so graphic war that people will turn away from it and mm-hmm. say, man, that's too yeah. ugly for me. I never want to be. But these Indian wars had been portrayed as very, more of the same, basically. You pick up some books like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, a very popular book in the 1950s and 60s, in colleges at least. And it's all, we're right back to square one. It's all Indians all good, white man all bad. White men all trying to steal what Indian has. And honestly, it is true in that regard. Yes, we wanted that land, the white people did. We wanted it so much that we were willing to go to war to take it, and we did take it. The thing that's left out of this narrative, that's always left out of the narrative because it doesn't square well with our current occupation government, is that the Indians, back in the 19th century, understood perfectly well exactly what was going on. They weren't laying around whining about the unfairness or the lack of justice. They understood because they had been doing the very same things themselves. In other words, long before the white man ever came upon the scene in America, Indians had been doing virtually the same things to one another. In other words, you've got this circle of violence round and round. You've got the Sioux being chased out of the upper Midwest, where the Great Lakes are at. You have the Sioux Nation being chased out by the Potawatomis and Ojibways, people like that of the forests. And the Sioux, in turn, are pushed into the prairie, where they suddenly come across the horse, and they're turned into some of the finest fighters the earth has ever seen. But they're being pushed out, and so what happens there? They start pushing out the Indians that are in their way, the Crow and the Shoshone. And so what happens there? The Shoshone are powerful tribes being pushed out by an even more powerful tribe. They push out the Kiowa and the Comanche and so on. You've got this circle, nonstop circle of war and violence. And so when the white men finally crossed the Mississippi River, which is right down the middle of America, crossed over and started heading west, their soldiers and the pioneers, the Indians understood what was going on. Here was another bully who had showed up on the scene, a big bully, a really big bully. And so quickly, the little bullies who had been pushed around by the bigger Indian bullies started forming alliances with this big white bully that came on the scene. So one of the things that's almost always left out of narratives about the American Indian Wars, this wasn't all white against all red and vice versa.
No, exactly.
There was crossover. Yeah. White men could have probably never totally conquered the West as he did in the time that he did without the help of these little bullies, and their alliances with the white man. In other words, the Crow and the Shoshone that I mentioned quickly joined forces with the white man, and so did the Pawnee, because they wanted revenge upon the Sioux and the Cheyenne, these bigger tribes.
Yeah.
By the same token, and I'd never seen this until I'd done the research myself for Scalp Dance, there are lots of whites that went over to the Indians and fought with them.
Huh.
Not just half-breeds, not just those French and Scottish who had married into tribes, although they were there also. But one of the funniest phenomenons that ever occurred in battles was that Indians started coordinating their attacks with bugle calls that emulated perfectly the white man. In other words, you've got, yes, some Indians did master the bugle, so they knew what they were doing. They could, in other words, two toots, and that means you attack. Three toots mean you go north and then come back around. In other words, you could, you know, the Indians weren't stupid, especially the Cheyenne and the Sioux. Very intelligent, very, actually, among the tribes, I'm getting off a little bit, Henrik, and you can edit this out if you want to, but of all the Indians in America, or maybe all the Indians anywhere, the Sioux and the Cheyenne stand out dramatically. Why is that? Well, they were very good at what they did. That was fight and ride horses. Someone has called them the greatest light cavalry the world has ever seen. And when you've got people like the Cossacks you're talking about, and you're saying the Sioux are better, that means they're really damn good riders. But they're also big people, tall people, pale people, generally pale. Yes, in spite of living out in the sun, it was still noted by the people that saw them. They had features very similar. People compared them a lot to some of the southern Mediterranean-type peoples, the Spanish and the Italians, because they were fairly fair-skinned, yet they had these magnificent faces. You can still see it today looking back in some of the old photographs of them. And so it's been conjectured that these perhaps were some of the people that originally came over 10,000 years before. I don't know if you've heard about Kennewick Man. I'm assuming you have.
Oh, yeah. We've spoken about the Salutrians not too long ago, actually. Absolutely. Very interesting.
Yes. And in fact, let's face it, you've got tribes, Sioux, Indians, and Cheyenne that are 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", very tall people. And then from the same race, you've got these Digger Indians that are probably 5'2", 5'3", that are digging roots and eating lizards down south. And so it's really a weird strain of the Indian race. But anyway, back to the story. It's trying to make some sense out of the whole thing. And the book, I wanted to portray life on the prairie and death the way it really played out. More especially, I wanted to know. Well, I have been criticized. Those who find criticism, who bring up criticism of scalp dance, say it's only in the words of the white people themselves. For the most part, they're right. Indians didn't have a written language, and the accounts they left were vague and nebulous. Many of them were. I tried to use as many as I could that were translated into English. Of course, I don't read Cheyenne or Sioux or Comanche. And so I used as many as I could, but they were, they would become repetitive and redundant. So yes, indeed, scalp dance is, for the most part, in the words of the white folks themselves.
Why not? If that perspective is left out today of the history books anyway, right? Then that deserves a viewing in my book, you know?
Yeah, you're right. But again, I pride myself on objectivity, Henrik. I try to remain neutral. In every book I've ever written, of course, I'm not neutral. Of course, I've got bias. Of course, I have prejudice.
Everyone does, yeah.
But a history book is no place to parade that prejudice, and that's what I've prided myself on. In fact, I've taken very few critical comments from anyone very few people can criticize the book for its blatant bias. In fact, I can't think of one right now about bias. And so I've succeeded there. And I try to portray the American Indian Wars as accurately, as honestly, and as fearlessly as possible. And according to you and people who have read the book and the reviewers you're talking about, I've been successful in that. What do I mean by that? Well, it's the things that are, if not necessarily covered up, then haven't been covered. Well, for instance, there are some things in scalp dance that are horrifying, absolutely horrifying. I don't know if there's ever been a bloodier, more sadistic, and just war anywhere. I don't know of anyone, any group of people who have fought like this before, because we're talking a first world nation running head on into the Stone Age. The Indians, no matter what they are today, or even how, even back then, there were some wonderful aspects of these Stone Age people that could be emulated by any society. But believe me, when they fought, it was the most terrible thing on earth because, there are accounts in there. I describe not just the battles themselves, which, quite honestly, usually I find rather dull, battles themselves, except when it comes to the Sioux and Cheyenne, because they understood tactics, and they weren't afraid to use them to devastating effect. But it's what happens after the battles that were as much interesting of as interest to me as anything. No book I've ever read, and certainly no film I've ever seen, portrays the way it really happened.
Right. Yeah.
Indians. The fact is, Indians fought to capture people. That's the whole function. Once you understand that, yes, it's to kill them if there's no other way out of it, but Indians would prefer to capture somebody, and I think you know why. Indians lived for torture. They lived for torture. It was the highest art form as far as they were concerned. That was their R&R. That's their trip to Disney World. Torture. To capture somebody alive. I'm not just talking about white people either. I'm talking about capturing anybody in battle. But brother, let me tell you what. There's a chapter in the book. It's called The Last Bullet. And The Last Bullet was a stock phrase on the prairies during the fighting when it was going on. Basically, it said, save that last bullet for yourself. Don't you dare shoot that final bullet.
Right.
Save it for yourself. Once you realize there's no hope, you cannot get out of this, put it to your head and blow your brains out. Because if you don't, you'll regret the day you were born. Because once an Indian got a hold of you, well, for instance, there are many ways of torturing someone. Let's just start with, if you want to hear it, I'm willing to describe it.
Well, sure. I mean, this is what it is. We need to get it out there. So go ahead. Yeah.
One way of torture, while a person's alive, keep in mind, it's no fun torturing a dead person. In fact, they're just mutilated. They're not tortured. Is to start an inch on your foot, slice a little bit of foot an inch wide, and then make two other strips, cuts on both sides, say an inch, and then start pulling that up. And the skin is made in such a way that it will pull all the way up to the top of your head, and then back down the other side. In other words, you're being skinned alive one inch at a time. And then he'll do the other foot. And this could go on for days. You know, you're staked out generally. And if they want to do the other side of you, they'll flip you over. And just keep that going until eventually you seep out. And that's, could be talking days. It just depends on how quick the Indians want to get out of there. Another very slow torture, and torture, it has to be slow. Death is not a part of the picture when it comes to torture. Life is an agonizing, horrible life. But is to start to stake somebody out with rawhide, wet rawhide that will, as it dries, actually stretch you even further. And stretch rawhide across your head the same way that you can't even move your head. Stake you out, and then start a very small fire on one foot, near one foot. Cook that until it's black. Then move to the other foot. Cook that till it's black. Then move to the hand. Then the arm. The other arm. Another hand. And then when you really are finally getting close to the grand piece de resistance, start a fire right in the man's chest, a little ember or two, and keep it going with the leaves and kindling and little sticks until it eventually burns a hole right down, and then your party's over. In other words, you finally killed that person. This, like I say, can go on days. This is not me making this stuff up. This is stuff I found out in my research. People who have come across this or interrupted torture fests and seen what was going on. There are people today, and I think it's our worst enemies, too, by the way, who say such stupid things, or the white chills who hate themselves so much that they will say such things. They will say things like this. Well, that was the Indian's religion. That was his nature. He was basically adhering to his religion. When he tortured, it was part of the bigger picture. That was to appease the gods or whatever, the great spirit. And they go on with such noodle-headed nonsense, saying such stupid things as that, you know. But what nobody ever comes back at them and says, well, you know, that's quite a great spirit, that's quite a god they're praying to by torturing somebody. Yeah. You could say the same damn thing for any amount of sadism that's committed by any white person. Well, hell, that's just our religion. That's his personal religion, not my religion. But him torturing or raping or being a serial killer, that's the god he's praying to.
No.
So you could make that comment, but that's the fact. The Indians, and it's not me saying it, Indians did fight to grab people alive and torture them. Now, women, it was another matter, and that's something else that's left out of all books, all movies that I'm aware of, is the nature of rape among Indians. As I mentioned to begin this conversation about the movie Little Big Man, let me say this. There's a movie, 1939. Have you ever heard of an American director named Cecil B. DeMille?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly.
Okay, he made these grandiose, extravagant, expensive movies. They were awesome.
Ten Commandments, you know.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, in 1939, he made a movie called Union Pacific with the American actor Joel McRae playing the lead. And Barbara Stanwyck, an up-and-coming young starlet, she was playing the saucy little Irish gal whose father was an engineer, I believe, a train engineer. But anyway, there's one scene in this movie, Union Pacific, in which the Indians have derailed a train. And it's a freight train, I believe. But anyway, the Indians had derailed it, and of course it's all laying over there, steaming and splinters and burning. And they killed the engineer and the fireman and the man in the caboose. But inside one of the boxcars is Joel McRae and Barbara Stanwyck. They hitched a ride. But the Indians, of course, they have control of the wreckage, and they're moving in on this boxcar because they sense that there's still some people alive. And Joel McRae, being the savvy scout that he was, he knows this is not good. It's not good at all. Here I am. It's bad enough to be killed or tortured by these guys, but they're going to get this woman. And what Joel McRae does is draw his pistol, cock it, and puts it to her head. Just as he's about ready to blow her brains out, she says, "Listen, do you hear it? Do you hear it?" And she said, "Listen, it's a train whistle. It's coming. It's going to save us." And Joel McRae, being the savvy individual that he is, he knows that she is hallucinating. And so he's going to get with this and kill her before the Indians get a hold of her. Well, the fact is, it was a train coming, to make a long story short. And they did drive the Indians off, and he did not kill Barbara Stanwyck. They couldn't do that in the movie back then. But compare that with Little Big Man, with the little boy and this teenage girl in the same situation. Indians are closing in. And, of course, you know, she's talking about, oh, it's terrible. It's a fate worse than death. I can't stand it. They're going to rape me. She's praying they do, of course. And, of course, they don't in the movie. In other words, they just basically, they're just anybody else. They're like, they adopt the kids, take them back. Nobody would think of raping this young girl. Well, in my book, I think you know which example is the actual, truthful, factual example. Mm. Rape. And I have a chapter in the book called A Fate Worse Than Death. And writing that chapter, I studied roughly 12 to 15 women who were captured by Indians. I forget the exact number. But A Fate Worse Than Death, it sounds very melodramatic. It sounds very Victorian, very 19th century. And today, let's face it, you say that to an audience, A Fate Worse Than Death, and they'll moan, roll their eyes and say, oh, yeah, right. We don't believe that. You know, Indians were just good, decent folks. Well, they may have been good, decent folks, but they also loved to rape, especially white women when they captured them. Of the 12 to 15 women I studied, and I wasn't selective in this. I accepted the first 15 that came to me. Mm-hmm. I would have willingly, happily put in a contra account, but of the 12 to 15 women, all, of course, were raped. Not one chose, after she was either rescued or surrendered by the Indians, not one chose to stay with the Indians. Not one fell in love with her a red rapist. In fact, quite the opposite. The women who were finally rescued by the Indians, and when they had a chance, they tried to kill their captors. They were so, what they had been put through. Truly, it was a fate worse than death, and people think, that maybe I'm exaggerating on this. I really hate doing this normally, but, well, let me briefly say that if you were captured by Indians, you were immediately, as soon as they got through tearing things up, the liquor, let's say they attack your wagon train, they will tear your clothes off and rape you right there on the spot. They will rape you as many times as there are Indians who want sex, and then even some after that and sodomize you. If your child is screaming or crying or trying to protect you, that child will have its brains bashed out against a rock or a wagon wheel. Generally, anybody that's of no use to the Indian is killed immediately, and that goes for the babies. Babies are, you know, just small baggage. Indians don't need them. Indians will take you back to the camp, and you'll be, if you don't want to go on your own, you will either have your hair braided into a horse's tail to force you to follow along, or you'll have a lasso, a lariat, throw it around your neck, and you'll be dragged. Once you're back in the village, really bad things begin real quick back there. You think it was bad, the rapes and being dragged back to the camp. That's where slavery really begins, because that's where you're expected to work carrying 300-pound bundles on your back, and I'm not exaggerating about that, of sticks or whatever it is they're trying to bring up to the camp, water. The squaws generally are very jealous of you. They will beat you. If you don't succumb to the man who owns you. And by the way, I should say this. Even though you're claimed by a man, perhaps a big man, perhaps a chief, that generally doesn't mean anything. It just means he gets you anytime he wants you. If he wants to give you to somebody else, you're given. He can do anything he wants. He can sell you. He's like a pimp, and you're like his prostitute. If he wants that man's horse, or mostly if you're new goods, he might get 14 horses for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For one sex tryst. As your value goes down, he might get two horses. And then eventually, when it really goes down, he'll trade you to some low man. And simply because one man claims you, as you can imagine, doesn't necessarily protect you from rape by others. For instance, Catherine German, that's how all this began. I was actually working on a book about her situation. Are you going to try to write a book about her captivity? Catherine German must have trembled every time she went for wood and water for her chief, for her lodge, because she was raped anywhere from 1 to 6 times per trip. 1 to 6 times per trip. I'm not making that up. She told an American Army officer's wife after she was finally rescued of this. She would have never written a book and said, I was raped. This came down secondhand from the Army officer's wife. That's what I mean. Well, okay, and let me say this also. You're being worked half to death. You've got grooves in your shoulders from carrying these enormous, large bundles of logs and wood and water, and your job never stops. Never stops. If you're not giving sex to anybody who wants it, basically, you're being lashed by a squaw who's envious of you, jealous of you, hates your guts. Not everybody, but generally, as a rule, let's say that for Catherine German, she tells me in the book she did write what she's thinking. She went to sleep every night thinking, praying that she would hear the notes from a bugle as it was sounding the charge as the cavalry came to rescue her. What Catherine did not know was that those bugle notes would have freed her, but not in the way she imagined they would have freed her from this life, because almost up and down the line, when an Indian is trying to get away, they will kill their captives. When the white man is attacking, they will almost always kill their captives. So Catherine would have died. Fact is, she was eventually surrendered because the Indians came back in the winter and gave up, went back to the reservation. And interestingly enough, I'm going to pass along this anecdote, which was so fascinating, is the reason I got so caught up with Catherine German, a 17-year-old young woman who was coming across Kansas with her family. And by the way, her entire family, mother, father, brother, two older sisters, were killed by the Indians and scalped. But she, her 12-year-old sister, and two little girls, her two little sisters, 5 and 7, were captured by Indians. And I should say, when they were recaptured by the white men, both were pregnant, except for the little girls. They were also brought in. Mm-hmm. But what got me so interested in Catherine's story was fairly typical, quite honestly, of the other women I'd studied. But Catherine, somewhere out on the high plains of North Texas or eastern New Mexico, at one of the Indian camps, somewhere she found a bottle, a cork, a pencil, and a piece of paper. And this young woman was so desperate to escape the Indians that at one of these camps that the Indians made for the night, she wrote down a note, a desperate plea for help. Help me. Please help me. I don't know where I am, where I'm at, but please help me. Save me. And then she corked that in the bottle, signed it, of course, and corked it in the bottle and tossed it into the headwaters of the Brazos River, which is, even in the best of times, out in that area that I'm talking about, northern Texas and eastern New Mexico, even in the best of times, it's barely a trickle of water, hardly enough to float a little bottle. But Catherine still had that bottle, that star of hope that she lived with during her captivity, that maybe somebody would find that bottle, uncork it, read it, and then come to her rescue. Now, the sad fact is, Catherine, after 5 or 6 months, was eventually returned, as I mentioned, to the reservation, and she went on to live a rather unhappy life after that. But 2 months after Catherine's rescue, after she was brought back, 2 months later, down on the Gulf of Mexico, on the beach, somebody walking along the beach found a bottle, and when they picked the bottle up, they uncorked it. And they pulled out this note. They fished the note out, and there was the written account of Catherine German.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reason I know that is because it's mentioned in one newspaper, only one, and you had to really dig for it. But there's no mention of what happened to the bottle. And can you imagine somewhere today, that bottle's probably sitting on somebody's shelf right now. They have no idea where it came from or what it is, but it was passed down from generation to generation. You know, a curious little antique, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I can almost guarantee you that's where it's at today. But that's why I became so interested in that story, was the bottle.
Right.
But again, back to the women themselves. Catherine's situation was very similar to the rest of them. There was some variation there, of course. But generally, that's the way it played out. Almost all women, if they were lucky enough to survive, were pregnant. And some of them had children by their sides, and were pregnant also.
Mm.
But it's not the scenario we've been led to believe. You know,
right.
I remember in the 60s vividly, you could go into a bookstore and there would be these lousy harlequin romances that are, you know, for the simple-minded women who want to read this stuff between watching TV and soap operas. And it would have these pictures of like an Indian chief and the white woman is the princess and she's, so in love, and they're watching a sunset or something, and they have some moony title, you know, like Wild Love or something. But anyway, I remember seeing things like that, and, you know, back before I had a thought in my head, I suppose, and that's generally the impression I was left with, that it really wasn't that bad, that captivity among the Indians, maybe it's rough in the around the edges, but generally it's a nice... very thoughtful, very a nice time in general that you're spending with the Indians, and that people really wanted to stay with them. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing.
So it's, of course, this very skewed version of history that we were battling against. It's been romanticized. It's been something which, you know, comes in the heels of, you know, the noble savage kind of myth to a certain extent, right? And so, what would you say to those who say, well, you know, let's assume someone argues like this. Well, you know, the white man didn't belong in America anyway, right? So basically all they did was fair game, or they had any right to do what they wanted to do. I guess when you start reading some of these accounts, you would say you'd beg to differ, right?
I would say that, you know, it's one thing for us to sit here and criticize people back then using our own scale of opinion. I simply cannot judge those people back then. They were doing exactly what their genetic makeup told them to do, and we're doing any more than I suppose. Right now, we can be criticized in 100 years. People will look back.
Oh,
at
sure,
us,
of course. Yeah.
And so, you know, we're just doing the best we can right now. So, no, that's not fair, and I refuse to jump onto that.
Yeah.
If people want to. I would question their motives when people want to criticize the whites for being whites back then. These are still the same people that are criticizing us today for being whites or wanting to stay white.
Also, as you said before, Tom, I mean, there was the view today is to take this kind of that the the lowest common denominator was race, and it was all on racial lines, and that's like, you know, the white man came there frothing at the mouth, seeking to kill as many Indians as they could. I mean, that's not the case, right? As you said, there were allegiances between different tribes. In some cases, I think Christianity played a big role in this too, that you know, if they viewed, you know, that some were have accepted Jesus or they were converted to Christianity, then they were as much part of their civilizations as they saw it as anybody else. And it wasn't at all depending on what skin color or genetic, you know, lineup you had, right?
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, there are things that – here's some other little things. The book – I like to think that my books are just full of detail. Detail you'll never find anywhere else. And, of course, they're annotated. So if you don't believe what I'm saying, just run down this source. For instance, George Custer, he's become the epitome or the symbol of avaricious white rapacity. We're basically, you can put all your hatred and all your feelings against whites into this one man, George Armstrong Custer. Fact is, Custer, his best friends were Indians. The fact is, Bloody Knife was had to be his best friend. Custer was so in tune with his Indians, his scouts, and even his enemies, that was his hobby, was studying these people. He knew that they weren't going to be around much longer. He knew that there's no way that these Stone Age people separated in various tribes were going to be able to stand up against this white juggernaut that was headed their way. And so he did his best to find out as much as he could about these people. He learned their language. He learned their customs. In fact, as the Indians, his scouts, his Crow scouts, were having their bon voyage party, you might say, just before the Little Bighorn, as they were leaving the river to go toward the Little Bighorn, the Indians were doing all their customary war preparations, riding around in circles. In other words, pumping themselves up to get ready for what is going to be, even then they knew that was going to be a big fight. Guess what? They left out something, and Custer told them about it. Hey, you left out blah, blah. I don't know what it was. He doesn't say. But they left out one part of that custom, and the Indian said, you know, he was right. And so they went and did it again.
Mm-hmm.
Custer understood the Indians as well as the Indians understood themselves, I think, or maybe even more so. There are numerous instances, and far from being either side being wildly bloodthirsty for the blood of one another, there are numerous cases of Indian red-white friendships, cordiality. In fact, there's one anecdote. It's about a Crow Indian, I think he's, or a Shoshone named Bear Tooth. And he hangs around this fort a lot. A lot of Indians did that were not on the warpath. They just hang around forts. They were actually called hangarounds, because they set up the teepees right outside the gates. And let's face it, there was lots of things the white man had the Indian loved. Everything. Not just the booze either, not just the liquor.
Yeah, well, the horse was not native to the American continent, correct? It was brought by the Europeans.
Yeah, it's true. You know, funny thing about the horse, though, and things I when I researched this book, I thought I knew a lot about it. I knew very little, actually. The Indian pony, as they called it, was quite a different animal than the American horse, as they called it. The American horse was a large animal, large and strong, and fed on grain and oats, and quite honestly, very ineffective in the Indian wars. The Indian pony could run circles around the American horse. The Indian pony was fast. He was fleet. He could run all day. He could live on sage and ditch water. I mean, he could live on anything. And when an Indian was on top of his pony, don't forget, an Indian was raised on a pony from the time he was a baby. So it was like one animal, a man and a horse. They were like one animal. And there's no white man that was living on a horse at the time. We were Johnny-come-latelys. If we were in the cavalry, we learned to ride a horse. Not every man back then knew how to ride a horse. And so that's why the Indians did so well against us. But, you know, I think I'm going off on another rabbit trail here.
Well, no worries. Oh, yeah, finish that point if you want.
Yeah, the horse. But anyway, this old Indian named Beartooth, he would come in by and by every so often and just sit and talk in sign language and in the English and a little bit of Crow or Shoshone, whatever it is, with the major who ran the fort. And the major really liked old Beartooth because he was a thoughtful man. He was certainly honest. And he, unlike many Indians, as the major points out, he didn't beg. Virtually all Indians beg. Even to this day, you run into some Indians, they'll be bumming something off of you, either cigarettes or a dollar for booze or whatever, even to this very day. No, not all of them, but the ones I grew up with were. But and so he loved Beartooth. But anyway, Beartooth came in one day and he said, "Tell me, my brother," he said, "tell me this. We have had tribe members that have gone back east and seen the Great White Father. And they have come back to the prairies and they have told these fanciful tales. They have been smitten by medicine. Something bad and evil has taken hold of their brain. They tell us stories like the white man is so numerous. There are more numerous than the grass. There are so many white men that even if you counted all the leaves on the trees, you could never count all the white people." And Beartooth said, "Tell me, my brother, you have never lied to me. Tell me this is not so." And the major thought for a minute on how to say this. And he said, "My brother, you know I've never lied to you, and I won't lie to you now. What these people say is true. The white man is more numerous than the grass, more numerous than the leaves on the trees." And he said, "That's simply the way it is, and they're coming this way." And Beartooth listened to him very patiently, and his head fell onto his chest. He walked out. He never came back in again. That's what I mean by details in history. It's not all about the major events. It's things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, to back up what Beartooth had just heard, most Indians believe that way. They believe that the white people they saw out on the prairies, a few hundred, a few thousand at most, that was it. Because that's all they knew was their circle of life out there. They had no concept of beyond the Great River, beyond the Mississippi, back toward the Atlantic coast. They'd never been there. Most of them would never be there. But those who did go back there, like the people who came back to tell Beartooth tribe what they'd seen, they went there. They saw the thousands in the streets of Boston and New York and Washington. They saw these enormous, enormous wigwams, these huge teepees, like the Capitol that went up to the sky. They saw the thousands of people. They saw the power and strength of the white Americans. They saw the ships like forests in the water with their masts sticking up. And they came back and they told the same stories that Beartooth's people had said. And of course, the people thought they were, had suffered bad medicine to come back so crazed. Well, one day a Quaker was traveling around taking pictures of Indians. This tribe he's happened to stop at was Kiowas. And he had a bunch of old photographs he'd been taking back east. And he started showing them to the Kiowa tribes. And here were pictures of soldiers marching after the Civil War. There were street scenes of New York, scenes of these huge canoes with smoke coming out of the stacks, of course, the riverboats, and on and on. And the Indians were looking at these, and they were just dumbfounded. In fact, one Indian, a chief, just kept hitting his mouth, you know, like that. He just couldn't believe. And one Indian who had been back there, who had come back from the east and had told him that and had been ridiculed by the tribe, he looked at the picture and says, "Okay, now what do you think? Now you think I'm still lying? Now you think I'm crazy?" There's the proof right there. So that's the way it was out there. And that's what I love putting in my books are these anecdotal details that just make history come alive and are rich. But then again, on the other hand, the book is about battles all the way from Sand Creek, which was... Have you ever heard of Sand Creek, Henrik?
Yeah, I have. I have. I don't know much about it, but I've come across it.
Well, it sets the table, more or less. I use it in the prologue, and I use it for a real strategic reason. Sand Creek has come across as the epitome, or the apotheosis of white America's crime against the Indians. We attacked, surprise attack upon this peaceful Southern Cheyenne village in the dead of winter. When we the ones we didn't kill, we cut their heads off, scalped them, cut women's breasts off, did terrible things, did extremely terrible things. And it's true. I'm not going to say that it's not true. It's true. What's left out of that narrative is why these white people were so furious,
right,
and so sadistically inclined. What is left out is what the Indians had done in that area, Colorado, the preceding summer. They had staked out women. They had cut them in half. They had brained babies. They had did some of the most terrible things imaginable. And with all the rest of the things thrown in, the rapes, the captivities, the burning people alive, these soldiers, these rough, tough frontier soldiers had seen all that, and probably some of their families had suffered. So when they got a hold of the Indians, they were not in any frame of mind to suddenly, hold your hands up, we'll take you to the rear, and we'll make you a POW. No, it was tit for tat. That's always left out. So I did that on purpose, because this sets the table of misunderstanding on both sides. One side commits a terrible crime, cutting women, scalping women, killing children, disemboweling people. The other side retaliates, and it goes on and on. It sounds very much like the Middle East right now, though.
Somebody
makes it's the same bullshit over and over.
Yeah.
One crime after another. At some point, it's got to all stop. But anyway, that's how the book begins, and the book goes all the way up to the Cheyenne Autumn episode, in which a band of Northern Cheyenne Indians heroically try to reach their homeland from Oklahoma, this hot, miserable reservation in the 1870s. A small band of Indians decide to break out from their reservation and go back home where the living was better and good. And it's very heroic, and they made it. And the white men, let us say that those who made it got to stay.
Right.
But the things they did on the way home were not very nice, let me say that. More atrocities that are always that were left out of the movie. A movie called Cheyenne Autumn conveniently left out all the atrocities the Indians committed on the way up.
Well, yeah.
Shooting all animals they encountered, torturing people, raping women, leaving them on the prairie naked. One man had his head stuck in a bucket, and then the Indians, for some reason, drove these enormous nails into the bucket. In other words, right to the man's head. But in between all of those two episodes, Sand Creek and the Cheyenne Autumn episode, or the battles we've heard of, Little Bighorn, things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that is the big crime, if anything, of excluding things like that to show, because it's all about how it's being used against people today. Really, that is somehow that is the extension of the crime already committed, as a way of kind of continuing that cycle of violence, really, that has been released. I mean, I think from, what's known as King Philip's War or Metacomet's War, when was it, 1675 to 1676, something like that. From that point onward, there's a lot of battles that are taking place, and as we said, there's some allegiances here and there, there's some, back and forth, but basically, at some point here, point being that this doesn't just come out of the blue. The American military, the organization of this idea that they're needing to do something about the situation, is a valid one. It doesn't just come out of the blue from a point of view which is, all right, we're just going to go ravage these people and take care of them, and that's it. There is a real effort, a realization here, I guess, right, that they can't live together with these people, correct?
I could not have said it better. Yes, of course. If there was a just war, this was a just war. I'm not so sure there is such a thing. But truly, yes, unlike the modern nonstop slaughter fest that we have going on right now. Yes, this and the American Revolution were just wars, in my opinion, because you're protecting people, for God's sakes. They would have not killed one Indian if the Indians had not killed the white people moving west. Simple as that. Do we still have time? I could talk some.
Yeah, sure, definitely. I wanted to round things up with the first segment here in a little bit, but let's get to what you want to give out here, and then we can talk about where people can get the book as well, Tom.
We were talking earlier about what is the function, what is the purpose of this anti-white crusade. They're using, of course, the Indians, and let me say this, I have nothing against the Indians. I know what the Indians were doing at the time. They were fighting the only way they knew how to fight. Now, the torture thing, that's their problem. I'm not going to go into that. They did it. And what can I say? It's horrible, and it's out there. I'm telling you, they did it, and so now it's out there. But you know, the reason they do this is because, yes, we do become self-hating, a self-hating race. Today, let me say this. A long time ago, 10, 15 years ago, I belonged to a historical group. And we had this one woman who would come in, and she would sometimes dress in buckskin. Now, she looked like she might have been from northern Norway. That's how pale she was. That's how fair she was. Not an unattractive woman, but blonde. Her hair was almost white. It was so blonde. But she came in, and she claimed, she told me very matter-of-factly, very sincerely, that she was Native American. That's what she told me.
Well, she was this, was she claiming that she was Sami or something like that?
I noticed when she would take something from me, or I would give her something, that her hand trembled like crazy. But anyway, she would insist that she was Native American. One time I spoke to this group, and I spoke about the book we're talking about right now, Scalp Dance. And I got right to the good stuff. I mean, I told them these anecdotes like I'm telling you. Well, she got out of her chair, walked out in a huff. That's what I mean by, you know, let's face it, this woman is like Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren is a nut job that's going to be running for American, for American presidency in a few years. And she claims that she's an Indian, too. Have you ever seen pictures of her? She looks like this woman I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Okay, I think that's part of the sickness that's pervaded, that seems to be so present right now, is that eventually you start becoming nuts. You don't want to be a white person anymore. You want to be an Indian. You don't want to be a victimizer anymore. You want to be a victim.
Mm, yeah,
and that's
yeah.
what this woman is all about, and I think that's what Elizabeth Warren's all about, quite honestly, are people, if you don't kill yourself to suicide, if you don't go drugs, if you don't go booze, then you go stupid like this. You start saying you're something you're not. You're anything but a white person.
Yeah.
Another thought is, you know,
I want to comment on that because it's a really good point. I mean, think about it. It's really disassociation with your own being. The mental virus, the sickness that arises from something like that is, I mean, it's incurable. I mean, it's really mind control. It's a psychological mechanism to break people up internally and divide them inside of themselves. So not being, you know, whole and complete and not being, you know, proud of who you are or where you come from. And largely a lot of this actually is done, well, there is a kind of a thing where people feel good about feeling bad about who they are. That's on top of it as well. But at the same time, largely this is imposed on people by the type of history that we're learning today, you know?
Agreed. Totally agreed. And I hate to sound like a sycophant and basically agreeing with everything you say, but everything you say is good. But let me say this, America, if you stop five people, you stop 10 people on any street in America, and you ask them, what is your racial background? Other than being white, what are you? German, Swedish, Italian, Spanish, Mexican? Generally, I'll guarantee you, of those 10 people, six will say they're part Cherokee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part Cherokee. A quarter Cherokee seems to be the going rate of exchange right now. But you will have people that will even go further than that. You will have people who not only claim to be a quarter Cherokee or whatever the Indian happens to be, and they'll always say it with a great amount of pride and dignity. But some people will actually dye their hair black, white people I'm talking about, part it down the middle, braid it, wear chunks of turquoise that would make any Navajo Indian jealous, and colorful beads, the entire, you know, the whole nine yards. And it's apparent. Now, these people would rather identify. I've got nothing against Indians, but let's face it. They would rather identify with what was, back then, a Stone Age culture than, let's say, identify with the Germans. They would rather identify with somebody like Crazy Horse or Sitting Bull, who tortured people to death, than they would Wernher von Braun, who sent us to the moon, or Wagner, who gave us the greatest music ever composed. Now, that's how sick Americans have become, that they would prefer that their DNA could be traced to Indians. And, of course, it's a lie, because Indians weren't that damn promiscuous. In other words, there wasn't an Indian in every woodpile. You know, there's no way that many Americans could have that much Indian blood in them. But still, that's the sickness.
It's sad. It's sad, but true. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I could go on talking.
Let's continue to talking here more in the second segment, Tom, as we pick up here. And let's just give out the title here again. We're talking about Scalp Dance, Indian Warfare on the High Plains, and that's from 1865 to 1879. Of course, the book is available on Amazon. Is there another bookstore out there, a website you'd like to plug where people can go to read more?
No, but it is in ebook form. Of course, you can buy it that way. I'm not sure how much it sells for. It's in paperback, probably about $17 now, and you can get it through Amazon, booksamillion.com, barnesandnoble.com, order through your bookstore. You can do that. Unlike Hellstorm, which, I have some copies here and I send them out all the time, I don't have any of these, so people will just have to do that. But it has become one of my best books, maybe still my best book, quite honestly. It was a main selection of the History Book Club when it came out. It was also a selection of the Doubleday Book Club. Of course, it broke into the mainstream press. The book was so well done and so irrefutable and so timely, I think, that it was clear that it was like one reviewer said about the book. He said, it's obvious. Goodrich has no axe to grind against the Indians, and I don't. I really don't. I have an axe to grind against people who would use Indians against us.
Exactly, yeah. And that's a big difference. And people should keep that in mind here, you know?
Yes. In fact, I don't care if every Indian owns a casino. If we're stupid enough to give away our money to an Indian casino, so be it. But anyway, that's it, the long and the short of it. It is, well, I don't know. It's a heavy book. It's a sad book. It's one of my best books, and I can, I guess I can recommend any book I've written, but this one I can truly recommend, that and Hellstorm.
Yeah, definitely Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany. We spoke about that last time, by the way, folks, so if you're, just tuning in, a new listener, what have you, check out that in our archives as we talk more about that. But we might go into more of that in the second segment as well, as we continue our conversation. There are a couple of more items I do want to bring up pertaining to at this particular time of American history. So we'll start there as we begin. But stay with us, Tom. Looking forward to continuing. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. We will continue and wrap up our discussion on Scalp Dance and the American Indian Wars at the beginning of the second hour as we continue. We will move on further to discuss, among many things, the Paris shootings, Christianity and Judaism in Europe. We talk about religion and European history before we move forward and discuss the current challenges that we face with culture wars and clashes that has been brought on by political decisions outside of the realm of most people, as the elite is seeking a clash of civilizations. We'll also speak a little bit more about the upcoming film on his book Hellstorm. It's an interesting continuation, so don't miss it. And of course, don't miss all our previous shows in full, all available for you at redicemembers.com. With a subscription, you have full access to our entire archives. Do try it out for 3 months and see what you think. Next up, we have Radio 314 with Robert Davis. And then we have Dennis Fetcho on the secrets of the kosher mark and the kosher tax. Thank you so much for listening, but stay with us here as we continue in the second hour coming up.